You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Mark.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I am doing well. A sunny California day.
You know, I envy you. California's nice.
California is nice. So when you spent the first part of your career on the East Coast and you moved to California, the tempo of life is so different. And it can lull you into a false sense of, which is one reason why, you know, sometimes I feel this sort of urge to jump back into Washington and get back in on the action.
A false sense that things are okay in the world, you mean?
I think it's less than that, and a false sense of that you actually, I wouldn't necessarily call it a false sense, because in some ways it gives you a perspective on the present, so you can actually enjoy what you're doing now, as opposed to constantly grasping for things and trying to advance your career. But
it makes you a Buddhist.
Yes. If your metabolism and the incentive structure for your career is predicated on publishing, 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 and scoop after scoop after scoop, which mine was at the beginning, it's very different.
Yeah. Well, that leads to an introduction of mine.
It's probably a better place to live.
A better place to be. So you're Mark Ambender. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on streaming video and audio podcasts. You are Mark Ambender, political journalist of long standing. You're out there teaching at at USC, right? At the school, the Annenberg School there?
The Annenberg School, yes.
Teaching investigative journalism. You recently wrote a book called The Brink, President Reagan and a Nuclear War Scare of 1983. Earlier, you co-authored a book called Deep State, Inside the Government Secrecy Industry. And both of these, you know, are, I think, kind of relevant to the current moment. I mean, the Brink is in part about, how tension between the Soviet Union and the United States had set the stage for a possible misunderstanding about whether the Soviet Union was or was not under nuclear attack, when they had technical reason to believe they were, and kind of how that unfolded. And of course, deep state is a term that's been much used, since Trump became president. So I want to eventually get into both of these books and their connections to the current moment and possibly their connection to each other. But let's start with the most recent place I heard the phrase or read the phrase deep state, which was in that famous New York Times op-ed piece by an anonymous administration official, right? And he or she, for some reason, I think of it as a he. I don't know why, but
I think we could perhaps make a probabilistic determination based on the number of senior officials in the administration who are he's, that it would be a he. So I think that's a if you're going to make an assumption that is one. One thing that struck me about the use of the phrase deep state there is that it seemed to be, even in a lot of iterations of how people use the term, sort of a misconstruction of what the deep state is supposed to actually be. I mean, this writer was basically talking about the administrative bureaucracy of government and people taking decisions to foil or perhaps shave off some of the president's worst instincts. It really didn't say that. It said really nothing about national security or the intelligence community or the law enforcement community or anything sort of generally associated with executive power, the power to kill, the power to imprison, to detain, the stuff that I would consider within the realm of what you might want to call the deep state. But here's the thing about that fascinated me, and it actually goes to the core of journalism today. I mean, if during the Nixon administration, the New York Times had published a similar article by an anonymous senior administration official, let's say John Ehrlichman, or someone, certainly the reaction from the White House would have been similar. But the reaction from the majority of the public would have been, I think, a lot different, because journalism and newspapers had an authority that was assumed by most people, where if they said, we have this anonymous official who's writing an op-ed and saying these things, you can believe it. You can take it to the bank. And what's fascinating now is the trend in journalism is, of course, away from trusting the authority of journalism as this mysterious entity, and more towards a very granular, this is how we do our reporting. We're going to show you every step of the way. We're going to try as best as possible not to use anonymous sources. But here you have the New York Times editorial page saying essentially to the entire world, trust us. And what gives this power to the piece is that trust and really nothing else. So it's an interesting editorial decision from that perspective, because I've in my liberal circles here in California had a lot of people say, well, why should we trust the New York Times that it's actually a senior administration official? And I would give my reasons. I trust. I mean, I have trust. I know James Bennett, who's the, you know, editor of the editorial page. Well, because he was my editor at the Atlantic.
You worked with him at the Atlantic.
And I trust him in part, so I have no problem trusting when he defines what he defines as a senior administration official. But it doesn't strike me unusual at all that one of the biggest questions here is who's actually saying this. I mean, what type of official is actually saying this, and why the Times?
Can I interrupt and ask what senior administration official means to you? You know, I was listening to the Daily podcast, which is a really good podcast with New York Times. Yeah. And the, what is it, Michael? Is it Barbaro?
Mike Barbaro, yeah.
Yeah, Barbaro. It was a very dramatic voice.
Yes, like, he does.
Amazingly dramatic voice. But anyway, so he was interviewing, I guess, the op-ed editor, James's deputy.
Jim Dow. Oh, James, yeah. Jim Dow's deputy, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, is it Dow? How do you spell it?
D-A-O, Dow, okay. Jim Dow.
So he said to Dow, so what does senior administration official mean? And Dow said, well, what I can say is that we use the same definition as our national security reporter, or as our reporters, the same definition that would prevail on the reporting side of the newspaper. And I was waiting for the follow-up question, and what is that? But it didn't come. And it almost seems to me that, like, newspapers who are going to use the phrase senior administration, they should almost literally just, I mean, literally, I think they should list all of the positions that constitute that category. I think they owe it to readers. Like, okay, you mean every cabinet official and the national security, but what exactly do you mean? So let me ask you, I mean, you, unlike me, have done this kind of reporting. I'm sure you have written things where you say, according to an anonymous, a senior administration official, what does the term mean to you?
Let me give you an even more specific example of where this was problematic. When Edward Snowden first gave his documents to the Washington Post and the Guardian and others, the Washington Post, in their first story, referred to him as a senior intelligence official. Now,
he didn't even strictly speak for the government, right?
Senior, you could certainly consider him to be a well-read or a plugged-in intelligence official, but even official was a word that I found suspect there. So I've always been very sensitive to the definition of senior. In my opinion, so we'll start with a working definition. Members of the cabinet would be senior administration officials because they are members of the cabinet. I would say that, in addition, anyone who holds the rank of assistant to the president, and that is probably, I don't know exactly the number, but that's 10 to 12 people.
So it's like national security, economic advisor.
Right, the head of the economic advisor, the chief strategist, the chief of staff, perhaps the deputy chief of staff, a couple of others, and then the communications director. And because the press secretary plays such an important role in shaping perceptions, I can extend that perhaps just down to the press secretary as well. Mm-hmm. But I've known reporters who will take deputy press secretaries and call them senior administration officials.
I'll bet a lot of people would take deputy cabinet heads as senior officials, right? Deputy Secretary of State, wouldn't they?
I think there's a case to be made that in the context of a story about diplomacy, they are. In the context of a story about the inner workings of the White House, they aren't. Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, it depends on whether they say senior administration official or senior State Department official. Certainly, deputy secretary of state qualifies senior State Department official.
Well, in this case, I mean, if the Times' national security reporting were the Times, their national security reporters would say a senior intelligence official. They would not say a senior administration official to refer to a senior intelligence official. And I think these definitions really matter because they convey to us, again, if all we're basing the power of this article on is the authority that the Times imputes to the word senior administration, we really need to have a good working definition of that. Now, again, I love James Bennett. I genuinely love the man. He has, and I trust him. So this is not, I'm not casting aspersions on his.
Well, neither am I. What I'm suggesting is that if there's a problem, if the Times has never spelled it out, the problem originates on the reporting side. Report, if they're going to use the term in the reporting, they could have long ago defined what they mean by it. It's natural that the opinion section would now, you know, use the term the way the reporting section does. But I think long ago, if the reporting section hasn't told us what they mean, they should have.
You've heard of the term journalese before, you know, the kind of conventions of journalistic lingua franca that from lingua franca that reporters will put into their stories, that there's almost an assumption that the audience should know what they mean but never really do. And I think this is the type of phrase that deserves or begs to be defined in a public forum or debated without question, and certainly by the reporters who use it themselves.
Now, before I interrupted you and asked you to define senior administration official, you were making a point, but it's been so long that I'm not sure what it was. Was there something else you wanted to say about this?
No, I mean, I think we sort of have it, but, you know, we can kind of go into, we can transition from that anonymous source to the Washington's leading and most profitable purveyor and exploiter of sources who wish to remain anonymous, Bob Woodward,
right?
You know, who I just read his book is now on its ninth printing, and I have to make a disclosure. I have a book that came out recently by the same publisher. So,
my most recent book was also a Simon & Schuster book. So we're both corrupted, but go ahead.
We're both corrupted, but at the same time, here's what I did not find the book to be surprising or shocking. And part of that, I was surprised by my surprise. I think part of that is, given the chaos in this administration, pretty much everything that in other administrations people might have kept for a Woodward-like book, they just went ahead and leaked immediately. So the number of actual scoops that you would have are just few and far between. And I read Woodward's book, and a lot of it is, when speaking in first person, when I was on this television show, I was asked about this and I said this, and then I got a call from this person. And a lot, there is I hate to say this, but there's padding, a significant amount of padding in the Woodward book. And there are a couple of really vivid scenes where the reporting seems to be top notch when he's talking about the internal discussions over Afghanistan, and certainly some very, some fairly rich detail in discussions about Trump's behavior on the campaign and his reactions to certain things. But there's a lot of chronological rewriting of things that we already knew. And it does seem as if there's a core group of five or six sources that he spoke to. He says he spoke to more than 100 people, and I'm sure he did. But a core group of five or six people that he spoke to who gave him a fairly distinct narrative that includes a lot of things, but leaves out, for example, most of what the president did with immigration policy and healthcare policy. And I understand that if the thesis of the book is to talk about the president's state of mind, that might be excised, but I think that's also simply the preoccupations of his sources. And one of the criticisms of Woodward, and one that he hasn't rebutted because I think he believes in this style of reporting as a modus operandi, is that he allows his sources to speak. Mm-hmm. And if a source says that somebody says something, or a source says that somebody was thinking something, then he'll simply relate that. And it's worked very well for him. So this might wind up being, ironically, one of his best-selling books, but also in terms of quality, not one of, I can't believe I'm saying this, but not one of his, not one of his better books. And there's one other thing about Gore that I found really interesting. So the day that the book came out, or the day that excerpts from the book were leaked, Woodward released the audio and a transcript of a telephone conversation he had
right
with the president.
With Trump.
So here's a question for you. And I don't know whether you've been a beat journalist before, but so let's say you've been trying to get the president.
The Daily Register in Shrewsbury, New Jersey for two years in the early 1980s.
That counts.
It does count. So I mean, it gives you a sense for the game. It was local reporting. Right. You know, zoning board, planning board, mayor, but it was for real for the people.
So here's the thing. So, all right, you finish this book. You have a couple of really fascinating moments, including a moment where the president orders the Secretary of Defense to kill Bashar al-Assad, and the Secretary of Defense doesn't, or Gary Cohn steals a memo off the president's desk, right? Two things you could describe in very quick sentences. And ask. So you get the president on the phone for 12 to 13 minutes after not being able to talk to him, understanding that the book was kind of put to bed. What would you do if you got the president on the phone?
Well, I think I know what you're going to say is, like, wouldn't you like to ask him some questions about the substance of the book, even though it's too late to put it in the book, right? I mean, it's clear what Woodward's agenda was on that phone call. Trump was starting to complain that Woodward hadn't even spoken to Trump. Woodward wanted to get it on the record that he actually had tried to speak to Trump and Trump's aides hadn't let him and whatever. And that's what the phone call was about from Woodward's point of view, right? That's
exactly.
Why with Trump's exactly. permission, of course. But are you saying that any reporter worth his salt at least says, by say, the way, are you aware that I stole something from your desk?
I mean,
from doing something he considered stupid.
Any reporter worth his salt, aside from Bob Woodward, because he's proven that he is worth his salt. But I would just ask the questions. I would say, thank you, Mr. President. Did you know that instead of trying to make a point about how you've ignored me for 6 months, which I understand why you released it, but it seemed a bit self-indulgent. And I would love to know, I would love to have Woodward, who asks questions usually pretty well and directly, ask the president on tape about Mattis and about Cohn, and he didn't. These are the types of things that have given me a little bit of a pause, and maybe as a journalism professor, I'm now more attuned to looking at some of these things in a different way than I was. But what it does do is it reinforces in my mind in a sense, that some of the reasons for journalism's authority crisis, although many of them perhaps overwhelmingly are due to economic pressures, there are sins of commission collectively that we as a profession have committed that at the margins can fray the bond that our readers might have with us. And even Bob Woodward, who is, and again, I'm not saying this just to clear my throat and to claw back on this, is clearly one of the best investigative reporters of our time. If even he is making some of these fairly elemental, I would call them craft mistakes, then all journalists can, and it's just something to watch for. But that's my opinion on the Woodward book.
Yeah, I have one other question about his technique. Now, I have not read a Woodward book since All the President's Men. Back, you know, I was in high school when Watergate happened, and watched the hearings on TV, and then I read the book. Great book.
Yeah.
And of course, this is for our younger viewers in the event that they may not know, this is how Woodward burst on the scene. He and Bernstein broke the Watergate story for the Washington Post. But I gather that in these books, I guess the first of his kind of books in the current genre was The Final Days, which was about the final days. And it was after All the President's Men. It was about the final days of the administration. And that's when he started doing this fine-grained scene setting, the president was dining on tuna, you know, common thing. But one thing he does as part of kind of sketching these elaborate narratives is he does, I gather, a lot of direct quotation, putting things in quotation marks. The president said this, so-and-so said that. And, you know, I wonder about that because, first of all, if you're relying on a source to tell you what the person said, even if the source has no agenda and is doing their best to reconstruct what was said, you know they're not going to get it right word for word almost ever. I wonder about that. And also I kind of gather that I don't know how the books are sourced in terms of, I gather he doesn't clutter it with a lot of according to so and so. Maybe he's got footnotes at the end that do. Right. But that also, if he doesn't have the footnotes, that's calling for an additional measure of trust. I really, for me, when I start seeing a lot of direct quotes where there clearly is no record of the quote, the journalist clearly did not observe the quote, and in some cases you're clearly relying on the memory of one person, I just get, you know, it for me, I just get skeptical. Even though usually it won't matter, usually the gist will probably be right. But
right. But again, I agree with you on those counts. But again, it's a shortcut. It's not the full truth as we know it and as best we can tell it. And if we claim that it is such, and over time, subsections of people who read us are looking for ways to discredit us, and I'm thinking us collectively broadly as a profession, that would be one of them, playing that we in our, you know, best efforts to create good narrative journalism will elide over what we now know about memory, or not now know about memory, but what is common sense about memory. And the one of the questions about Woodward, you know, the debate over the motives of Woodward sources, Woodward doesn't, he's not interested in debating motives, and that's part of his core conviction. But it is interesting. It is very interesting to read the historiography on Mark Felt, who was Deep Throat, and what Deep Throat's actual motivations were. And the things that Deep Throat actually knew that he never told Woodward, that had he told Woodward, might have led to an even speedier resolution to Watergate.
Is that right?
For example, Mark Felt was quite aware of the wiretapping of journalists, which was sort of the original sin that launched a lot of the other, after the Pentagon Papers and a bunch of leaks that came out of the National Security Council. Henry Kissinger was paranoid. You know, the story goes on, but, he was privy to a bunch of that because he was the deputy at the time. And, I'm not sure if he signed off on them, but he was privy to them. And, did not let on to Woodward that key piece of information that would have been so critical to kind of connecting the dots, among other things. All of which is to say that these first drafts of history are those, and should be treated as those. And I just know that in my own book, if somebody told me that they said something specifically, well, two things. I wrote a note at the beginning of my last book that said, things that are in quotations either come directly from a transcript of that meeting that was taken officially, from somebody's notes that were taken contemporaneously, or if somebody says that they said something directly, I will accept that. But but if somebody says somebody else said something, and I have other reasons to believe that will be true, I won't put that in quotations. I'll leave that in italicized, you know, sort of italicized convention there. That was sort of my accommodation to the realities of writing a narrative, but trying to be as truthful as possible. And my book, unfortunately, is sort of cluttered with said they said or things like that at times because I felt uncomfortable often.
Oh, so you actually say, You actually say, he said, according to him, kind of.
Right. He, you know, he remember, right. He remembers saying, I mean, there was this, you know, a scene where one of the central figures in the book is talking to his German counterpart and they're having witty repartee. And no question that the repartee at the time was witty, but I can't imagine that he could reconstruct it from.
I really applaud that distinction because when you say he recalls saying, you are reporting something you can vouch for. You were there when he recalled saying it. You are stating you know, one of the things you learn early in journal when you're doing newspaper journalism is just always attribute it to somebody. And then you don't have to worry about screwing up. If you know it's a fact that this person said this or this is according to so-and-so, that really greatly reduces the chances that you'll commit a factual error. Because even if it turns out not to be true, you didn't say it was true. You said they said it. And this gets to just one more little pet peeve of mine, and we'll move on to graver subjects. But one thing that has become standard in the Washington Post, New York Times, and others is that when you quote an anonymous source, you report why they are remaining anonymous, who did not want to name themselves because X. And I remember when this happened. I don't know if you remember, but Slate, when it launched, Mike Kinsley was so influential then that journalists really read Slate, and they had a thing called the Daily Paper or something, summary of the news with kind of attitude. It was done by Scott Sugar, the late Scott Sugar. He passed away quite a while ago. He had never been a newspaper reporter himself, and he came up with this idea. He had this hobby horse, like they say the person is won't speak on the record, or they say the person wants to remain anonymous. They don't tell us why. Well, I think now that everyone has adopted his recommendation of saying why, we can see why they didn't do it in the first place. And it gets back to this fact of only report what you know. You don't know why they're staying. You know, you don't confidently know what their actual motivation is for being anonymous. And yet the Times and the Post reported as fact. They don't even do what you're saying you did, which is say he said he didn't want to be identified because of this. They just say who did not want to be identified because of X. They don't know whether that's true. It's just a waste of time. And half the time it's obviously bullshit what they're saying. And I just, I'll calm down now. but it's such a waste of ink. And again, it introduces something that the reporter actually can't vouch for.
It induces a layer of you have to trust me. And trust is in short supply anyway.
Yeah.
And so I worry about stories that, you know, it's kind of like, what do they say about movies? Like you can have one, at least in any movie that's even realistic, one moment of suspension of disbelief and you're okay with that as a moviegoer. But more than one, it's kind of like, all right, we're kind of like, you know, this is a little ridiculous here. And I really think the same thing is true of pretty much any story that we read or watch or consume, we can impute a level of trust or trust me just so much, and we're conditioned now by partisanship and everything else to trust less and less. So as reporters, we have to change our practices so as not to do that. And I think we can. We just, you know, it's a function of journalism schools and people adopting new ones and stopping these conventions that I think are not harmful and are not helpful and annoying and don't add anything to the final product, what we're trying to actually do. I agree with you.
Now all this said, I totally trust the New York Times op-ed page's word on this being a senior administration official.
As do I.
And to get back to where we started, so you're saying by a prevailing definition of senior administration official, that means either a head of a cabinet or maybe a dozen other people?
Basically. Yeah, I would say so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, back to this deep state issue, which arises – in a way, in both that and the Woodward book, I mean, at least a kind of conception of the deep state arises. Like some people would say, when Woodward reports that a Trump aide pulled a document off of Trump's desk hoping Trump would forget about it because he was afraid Trump would do something wrong. Was that about Afghanistan or something, the Gary Cohn?
This was about Korea. This was about the Korea-U.S. trade agreement and a secret program that somehow would have immediately stopped that allowed. This is what I was tweeting about because I didn't quite comport with my understanding of how our missile detection systems work. But according to Woodward, there is a secret program that is based from our joint bases in South Korea that allows the United States to detect the launch of a ballistic missile from North Korea within 7 seconds, as opposed to, Woodward says, 15 minutes from Alaska, which is a little, again, I don't mean to get into this rabbit hole, but it's important, I think, to try to understand what the story actually says. There are early warning radar dishes in Alaska, but and there have been for 40, 50 years, but detection of ballistic missiles happens from space, and a ballistic missile launch will be detected, and I can guarantee you, if not any of the unclassified satellites, probably a classified satellite hovers over North Korea 24/7 and can pick up a ballistic missile launch within 7 seconds anyway. So it was just it was confusing, and also confusing because there wasn't any link between, okay, if you withdraw from the trade agreement or announce your intention to do so, would that immediately affect the signed military joint cooperation agreements that, incidentally, the United Nations also administers? There's just a context that's missing that sort of...
It wouldn't shock me if Cohn in talking to Woodward...
How would Cohn know about
it? ...was trying to add a layer of justification. I mean, assuming the source, which I guess maybe isn't clear. But if he was trying to add a layer of justification to the stealing of the memo, right? In other words, like, hey, the fate of the world was at stake, where, of course, Cohn's primary area of concern is just the trade agreement, right?
Right. And I have no doubt that there is a secret program probably having to do with feeding targeting data to, you know, U.S. artillery pieces that could shoot down a missile right after it launches. That's my guess.
Yeah.
But that's also not really that surprising or top secret. I think that's what we mean here, but the opacity of it made it kind of weird. But one thing about the deep state in this book, you know, Trump is told everything here. Nobody is keeping any secrets about secrecy or what the government is doing or what the government's secret intelligence capabilities are from the president. And in fact, they are still asking him, despite this example with Secretary of Defense Mattis, where Trump, in a fit of rage after the sarin gas attack, says, you know, literally kill the fucker. And Mattis says, on the phone, and then says to people.
Yeah, I'll get back to you on that.
I'll get back to you on that. But there's no sense that people are deliberately trying to keep information from the president in the book. And that makes the idea, the conception of a deep state that Trump and his supporters have always cited, very different than the historical notion of what a deep state is.
I think of the deep state as having kind of a continuum of meanings almost, and maybe we should start at the other end of the spectrum. I first heard the term deep state in the context of Turkey, referring to the period of Turkey's history when basically the generals, there would be a democratically elected leader, and the generals would sit around, and when the guy got out of hand, they would say, okay, time for a coup.
Right.
I mean, that's a deep state. They were actually ultimately in control in a not quite formal way, but in a completely reliable way. They would just every once in a while have a coup, say we're fed up. Now that's one extreme where,
and Thailand is a similar example where the deep state is this alliance between the military establishment and the royal establishment controlling the levers of power over an elected civilian government that if it crosses boundaries gets deposed, which sort of happens regularly. A state that exists beneath the state making decisions, policy decisions that are at odds with the stated policy goals and decisions of the civilian government.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, you might have someone in the entrenched bureaucracy, like the CIA. I mean, I know that you conceive of the deep state with particular reference to the kind of intelligence gathering apparatus. Is that right?
I do. And the way that I derive my term, I think I first came across it when I was young and a Kennedy assassination buff. But don't worry, now I think I'm surely Harvey Oswald did it. But I used to believe the opposite. And Fletcher Prouty, who, if you ever watched the movie JFK, he was the guy who was portrayed by Donald Sutherland in the one of the final scenes as this mysterious Mr. X who told Jim Garrison everything about the conspiracies behind the world. But this guy, Fletcher Prouty, was an Air Force colonel, worked in the Pentagon during the time when the CIA was just getting its sea legs and adventuring all around the world, doing a lot of little assassination plots and essentially trying to, which all, by the way, with the knowledge of the Eisenhower government, the Truman government, the Eisenhower government, and then eventually even after the Bay of Pigs, the Kennedy government. Robert Kennedy authorized more covert operations. He was given that authority by Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs. He authorized more covert operations than any president firm, but that's just a bit of a historical curiosity that I like to point out. Okay, so the deep state in that sense is the collection of people who have access to secret information and who have the power to do something with that information. It's not to me necessarily a nefarious term. It's simply people whose administrative work for the government is necessarily secret because it involves that part of our statecraft that remains in the shadows and has always been.
So in your conception, yeah, the deep state is not inherently a pernicious thing. There's always one in every government. It keeps the secrets and so on.
Think of back to Elizabethan England. Francis, Walsingham had his, 40 spies that he ran, or in Renaissance Venice, the council was the council that ran the city had to swear an oath not to disclose anything that was said in chambers, and had fought all these battles because there was a new printing press and people were printing rag sheets and rumors. I mean, these types of this battle between information or control over information, which defines what the deep state is a long-standing historical phenomenon that's associated with the way human beings organize themselves. Now, the deep state takes on a negative connotation when you add in the way that the deep state has been conceived of overseas and construed, which, for example, would include an organized group of people who are working to stifle or stymie the declared policies of the civilian government or the president of the United States. But one problem with that definition is that any one person with access to secret information can stymie a policy.
Well, J. Edgar Hoover had that kind of leverage over presidents and princes.
Right, but not even J. Edgar Hoover. Somebody with access to top secret information who is worried for, we've seen when whistleblowers began to talk to Dana Priest of the Washington Post about the CIA black sites, this was the deep state, very, very deliberately working at odds, were working against the state or the stated, although at that time, secret policy of the Bush administration on enhanced interrogation. So the deep state can act, or members of it, but I don't necessarily think that's a deep state thing. I think that's just a group of human beings who disagree about a policy for whatever reason and get together to do that. There is, though, one big difference with the Trump administration, and it is absolutely true that because of the contempt that Trump historically has shown, the deep state, like any other group of professionals, wants to be respected at a minimum. The contempt that the president has shown for them does not engender particularly positive feelings, and certainly loosens the permission structure, the decision rules, changes them in a way that would facilitate leaks and even more dangerous leaks of information to try and embarrass him. So when Trump says that there are people within the government maybe some Obama holdovers, maybe professionals in the government, civil servants, who are working at odds with him and who have security clearances. Absolutely right. I don't even think that should be a controversial statement because it's so obvious that that's happening and that's true. Now, put that in the context of everything else that's happening, and maybe that's not such a bad thing. But is that happening to some degree? Has it happened? Absolutely.
But I mean, don't you
think... Is that the deep state, though, manifesting itself in some way? No, that's a small group of individuals who are using this extraordinary power that more than a million people have because of the number of people with security clearances. So a tiny fragment of the deep state.
But this is why I think of it as a continuum. At one end, you've got a few actors leaking things in ways that may embarrass or constrain the president. And then you can imagine having a few more actors. And then you can imagine more actors and moreover actors who you can say reflect the kind of consensus values within the permanent part of the intelligence bureaucracy. I mean, for example, with the black sites, I don't know if there was a consensus against torture. Maybe there wasn't. But if there was, and that was really kind of a value embedded in the bureaucracy, then that would be a more straightforward manifestation of the kind of deep state, right?
Well, here's another way to look at that same question. When normally, given the extraordinary power of the president of the United States, any effort to check that power might be seen as a good thing. But the specific habit or the specific objection that the president has, most recently we've seen with his comments about the Justice Department, I think are direct attacks on a value embedded in the bureaucracy that's recent, meaning it's 30 to 40 years old. It was post J. Edgar Hoover, but it's essentially embedded throughout the intelligence community in the Justice Department, FBI, that as citizens, we should value, which is the professionalization and apoliticization of federal law enforcement investigations and national security matters.
Sure.
That is a check and balance that existed because of again, the professionalization, a professional cadre that existed. We can go into the church committee and no need to do that now. I mean, my deep state book goes into that. We can talk about that. But that development is one of the more salutary developments in the history of our national security establishment. Makes us all safer, increases the check on unconstrained executive power, and attracts good people to do those really hard jobs. And that is what Trump is taking direct aim at. Right. And that I don't like at all.
Right. And in that case, he's not really taking aim at the deep state or some nefarious manifestation. No. He's taking an aim at norms that traditionally have prevented a president from exercising what is often formally his right. Like he can fire the attorney general. He's the president. But but we have norms that make that harder to do, and he's attacking those norms. Now when you turn back to the intelligence bureaucracy, I just want to get clear on what you do and don't approve of. I don't recall the details, but certainly during Trump's administration, there have been leaks that emanated from the intelligence bureaucracy that were designed to embarrass or constrain or frustrate Trump, I assume. And I also assume they were technically illegal. The leaks must have come from someone who had sworn that they wouldn't do this, right?
Certainly. I think any national security journalist has to understand that there's an inherent tension that we simply have. It's an antinomy. We have to accept that our sources are doing illegal things to provide us with information, and often, frequently, the ends do justify the means. And if you don't think that, then
as a journalist, you think you should not make that call, right? If it's newsworthy and a source reliably provides it, you go.
There are between that. There's a lot of soul searching, or there should be a lot of consideration and soul searching and checking with other people and even asking the government, make your best case as to why disclosing this information is harmful. You have to do that, I think, for A, your own conscience, but also because as a journalist, you don't really, really know the effects of it, and publishing anything has externalities. That said, this is what we do. So yes, I mean, the shorthand you offered earlier is a distillation of it, but there are more steps in that process that good investigative journalists routinely and editors routinely do. And frankly, people inside the bureaucracy who are at senior levels who deal with journalists and have to work on them with lead, as I can, I won't name them, but people that I worked with and I was covering it on a daily basis understand that part of a give and take. And, you know, and sort of go there. But, when, for example, the transcript of a president's conversation with a foreign leader leaks, which may or may not have come from the intelligence bureaucracy.
Is there a specific case you're thinking?
Yeah, with the president of Mexico and then the prime minister of Australia. Potential damage to you leaked, clearly as a way to embarrass the president, because the substance of the conversation was the president was an idiot, and the foreign leaders were fairly bewildered. So it wasn't necessarily a dangerous story in terms of national security, but it sets a precedent for futures where if somebody leaks you a transcript, you just have a much easier time of saying, hey, this happened, so, you know, we can publish that. I'll give you one other example that I find disturbing, which is, remember when the president was talking with some Russians, receiving the new Russian ambassador in the Oval Office, and allegedly disclosed classified information about an ally's ability to track ISIS. Newspapers, when they first reported that story, and CNN and others, they went out of their way to say, we know more about this story, but we've agreed to withhold details about the specifics, because if we didn't, we would jeopardize an ongoing source of intelligence collection that, and then we could put lives in danger. I mean, this is what they said directly, which is fine. But you just, that's, whenever I see that, I just say, wait a week. And sure enough, within a week, the source had been exposed. And it was exposed, I won't give the name of the news organization or the reporter who did it, but some national security reporter for a major news organization simply tweeted out details of the source was based here and did this, which is interesting, but it blew up the source, and it blew it up in a tweet. So we live in an environment where the ease by, and I most likely, I don't know for sure, that reporter never cleared that tweet with anybody, just got the information, published it. And we live, and that's just tech, that is purely access to, you know, a means of publication that is just much different than before, combined with a competitive environment that, you know, you're constantly looking for bits and bits of information. But I worry that when we start as collectively as journalists just publish anything or publish things like that, we lose the credibility that we have when publishing really sensitive national security stories that have significant impact with people. We have to be able, people really, in a sense, the public does have to trust that journalists, although we can't quite know everything that the government knows, we consider all equities when we publish classified national security information. And when we clearly don't, and it becomes a feeding frenzy, it just makes it hard for everyone else. And I want to see the profession flourish, because I think, along with the rule of law, I think good journalism is one of the two main guardrails on that bowling alley. The strong rule of law and good, strong, independent journalism. You have those two things that are functioning, I think the country can survive pretty much any stress test.
Well, we may find out. So I want to talk about your new book, The Brink, about this, I guess, maybe near war with the Soviet Union in 1983. And then after that, I want to make a kind of a connection between it and this issue of the deep state and what we've been talking about. First, just to round out the deep state Trump, discussion, I guess maybe one thing I'm kind of trying to say is that when Trump talks about the deep state, he's not totally hallucinating. I mean, you can argue about how broadly or narrowly to define it, but there's a reasonable conception of the deep state according to which, yeah, he's a victim of it sometimes. I mean, yeah. So
yes, I would testify to that in court if I were ever asked.
Okay.
Yes.
So tell us then a little about your book. This is not all that widely known, a near disaster, is it?
It's not. It's certainly a lot more has come to light recently thanks to, the declassification of documents and amazing FOIA work that's been done by people like Nate Jones at the National Security Archive. But I've been fascinated by nuclear policy issues for a while, and I stumbled across this incident, and there were just a lot of questions that had not been answered in any form that I felt satisfactory. How close did we actually come to some sort of shooting war with Russia or the Soviet Union in 1983? How the hell could we get to that place when, although there were tensions, nobody wanted war? And what role did the nuclear command and control system itself play in heightening those tensions? And the book answers those. And it does so, I will say, by way of trying to sell it in a way that, you know, it is a fairly read about how spies and ordinary soldiers on the ground acting in service of the truth and at great risk to their families in many cases, were able to move minds and stave off a conflict that, could have progressed from conventional to nuclear very, very quickly.
So basically I gather the U.S. was doing some kind of military exercise.
Every year NATO still does this. They practice giving or transferring custody of the warheads that the U.S. maintains to the NATO allies. These NATO allies maintain the missile launchers. The U.S. maintain the warheads. And so that's kind of the arrangement, like a dual key system. So you got to exercise the transfer of them, right? The authorization to use them, the time it takes, the security you need at the bases. So this exercise was called Able Archer. And if you were looking at the base, at any of these bases that had these nuclear weapons from the outside, you would not have been able to tell that it's an exercise. And when you do this exercise amid a time of enormous tension and escalation and hedging, it's almost like you have in football a defensive line, an offensive line, and you know, a quarterback is making cadence saying how to hike and just trying to get the other one to go off sides, and they're trying to make moves. You have that situation where false moves, tiny false moves that in any other context or circumstance would mean nothing, in this case could lead someone to make a decision that's catastrophic. The Soviets and the East Germans in particular had standing orders to sabotage the army artillery detachments, the nuclear depositories where the nukes were, if they ever thought the tactical commanders in the field, if they ever had a feeling or really thought that war was imminent.
What form would the sabotage take?
The sabotage could take anything from messing up the communications, spoofing communications if they actually had access to nuclear codes, which there is some evidence that the East Germans had managed to place spies within the top secret vault and then the nuclear code vault, the 7th Army at Heidelberg, which is a scary thought. And not even some evidence. There's pretty persuasive evidence of that. That's one thing. Another thing is simply to be outside the base with a rifle and shoot the warhead. I mean, the warhead wouldn't have gone off. It would have exploded. It wouldn't have gone off most likely in a nuclear explosion, but if it had gone off, there had been a series of catastrophic explosions that could have prompted a response from the West Germans
On the one side, East Germans and Soviets who have been told to intervene if it looks like NATO going to launch an actual attack. And then now you've got NATO doing an exercise that by its nature looks very much like what it would look like if they were preparing an actual attack. Is that right?
Yes. And here's Bob, how we know that this was real and not just posturing. there were things that the Soviet Union and the East Germans did that NATO and the United States did not find out about or know about for a long time. If you're posturing for the enemy in our grand conception of nuclear deterrence, you want them to see what you're doing. Well, the Soviets deploy to their wartime position secretly their SS-20 Pioneer regiments. These are mid-range ballistic missiles. They did this secretly. They sent Nikolai Ogarkov, who was the Soviet equivalent of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, down to a bunker secretly. They dispersed weapons, nuclear weapons, secretly. They sent KGB officers. And these, by the way, are not saying we think they did this. These are things we know they did. They sent KGB officers down into ICBM silos. The KGB officers had keys that would allow them to override in case the missile officers there refused to. The KGB officers would shoot dead the missile officers and then turn the key. And they confined every Soviet military, students at military academy, to base for the first time ever in this period of the Cold War. The answer, there's a guy named Andre Babian who told me this. He asked specifically why, because he was going to get married that weekend, but he had to be confined to base. And the reason was, well, NATO is doing an exercise, but we think it's going to be a pretext for some sort of invasion.
And what had led the Soviets to think this was no mere exercise? On the one hand, they knew that ostensibly it was just an exercise, right? That part was known. Why did they think that, did they come to suspect that this was actually a fake, that the exercise was cover for an actual attack?
The U.S. nuclear doctrine had advanced to the point where it was no longer mutually assured destruction or mutually assured omnicide or even leadership decapitation. But several months earlier, New York Times had reported, most likely due to a deliberate leak, that our nuclear doctrine was now involved the capability to ride out a nuclear war, win a nuclear war on our terms, and limit a nuclear war to Europe, and that was where the U.S. was orienting its defense policy.
The Times reported that before this happened, but during
yes,
the Reagan
months before. But that's one thing, and Russians paid attention to the Times because they had some sense that the Times had an official sense of what policy was. But this was actually an actual. This was our nuclear. This was our top secret nuclear doctrine at the time. So starting from that level,
interesting question: why that was leaked? Yeah. What was it? Was it somebody who objected to the policy who wanted to get it out there, or were we sending a message to the Soviets?
Good question. Gut guess is the latter. Because incidentally, I mean, Jimmy Carter signed the purchase order on changes in our nuclear policy that Ronald Reagan wound up, you know, sort of receiving and implementing, which is, you know, a whole nother set of stories. But you have that. You have the development of very sophisticated electronic warfare programs that the Soviets were beginning, because of their spies, to get knowledge of, that included the ability to blot out the Soviets' nuclear command and control system. They knew the U.S. was developing these. You had President Reagan's rhetoric, the evil empire speech. You had the Soviet fear that Star Wars was the cover for some massive program of anti-satellite technology that would, again, wipe out any Soviet capability to wage war whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And you had the impending fielding of missiles, the sort of Euro-missile controversy. This was after the Soviets had fielded missiles of their own in 1978 that could reach NATO capitals, and NATO, after a prolonged period of debate, as tends to happen in democracies, was finally ready to field Pershing missiles to Europe and ground-launched cruise missiles, which could have targeted Warsaw Pact capitals and even Moscow from Europe. And then you have a series of really kind of scare incidents, right? Remember the shooting down of the Korean airliner?
Yeah, I remember
You have an incident where
This was the Soviet Union shot down a Korean airliner. I actually knew a guy who was on board.
And, oh, goodness.
And it was, I assume, a mistake, but Reagan made a big deal out of it. And rhetorically, weirdly, I encountered George Kennan in an elevator like a day or two after it had. It's a long story how it was a very funny kind of way to happen upon him. But he did not approve of Reagan's reaction. But in any event,
the intelligence at the time suggested that the Soviets confused it for a spy plane that was loitering in the area because there was an ICBM test that the Soviets were going to use later. And historically, that sense is held up. But the Soviets, again, the degree to which so the Soviets saw the reaction that the Americans had and said, well, the Americans are just lying because that clearly was not what we were doing.
Right.
And Americans don't usually lie. The other thing is, they knew that Americans don't usually lie about stuff like this. So they thought the anger was a bit feigned, but aggressive. And then you have incidents that, again, that if you are in the Soviet high command, you know about, but this is the famous incident where the watch officer at one of the Soviet command and control facilities, Stanislav Petrov, is tasked, suddenly it appears as if five ICBMs are launched from the west, headed directly at Moscow.
This is during the exercises, during Able Arc?
This is right before, this is about a month before the exercise, where it seems as if the U.S. has suddenly launched five ICBMs at the Soviet Union, and it's up to this guy, Stanislav Petrov, who's basically a watch officer, to decide whether this launch is real and wake up the high command, or whether it's, you know, some satellite problem with old Russian satellites. It was a satellite problem with old Russian satellites. They had detected the glint of sunlight off of clouds and determined those were ICBMs. But again, you just pack all these incidents into a compressed time frame where leaders aren't talking to one another, and you're getting partial intelligence about an aggressive nuclear exercise, and the Soviets have a history of themselves using exercises to invade other countries. Mm-hmm. You could begin to see where in the minds of not all Soviet leaders, certainly, but enough of them, hedging like this was worthwhile and making at least or making assumptions that NATO might try to do something was not out of the, you know, was not just some wild out of the blue concept.
So it wasn't one of these cases where during the climax of the tension itself, they saw some false reading on radar. It was just that, I mean, that had happened shortly before.
That had happened before. Like, that was a prelude to this, yeah.
But it was that just taking all things into account and in an environment of growing tension with no ongoing channels of communication between the two sides, the Soviets did a series of things that they set in motion a process that, unless checked, would have led to conflict, but I guess they never gave the final. I mean, strictly speaking, it remained precautionary. Is that I guess that's my question.
It did. And I think, you know, look, if you're a movie producer, this is sort of the movie producer question is, okay, who is the guy in this case who like pressed the button to say stop everything? And there are people. I mean, one of them was a guy named Lenny Perutz. He was an Air Force general who was the head of intelligence for NATO in Europe, who had detected all of these unusual signs of preparation from the Soviets, and could have ordered countermeasures taken that the Soviets themselves would have certainly, based on what we now know, interpreted as preparation for war, but instead did nothing because he didn't want to escalate tensions. So his silence in that situation, although he was insistent that NATO and the U.S. review what had happened to figure out what the hell the Soviets were up to afterwards. His actions, de-escalated the conflict as well, as did the intelligence of people like Rainer Rupp, who was the East German spy master's leading, his name, Topaz was his code name. At the height of the conflict, he got a sort of panic call that said, are you about to attack? And he said, no. He wasn't necessarily believed immediately, even though all the intelligence he had provided was good. And then you had people like Oleg Gordievsky, who was the KGB officer, a senior KGB officer who was spying for the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, in Britain, who was sending during this time, during the exercise, warnings that he was getting from Moscow that were increasingly panicked, that essentially said the U.S. and NATO seemed to be on the verge of war, and passing these messages along to the Brits, who were doing their best to keep the exercise contained. So there's no neat narrative. There's no, you know, one person pushes a button to save the day, but there's a lot of people in the moment of crisis acting with cooler heads, which probably reduced, well, which I think reduced the likelihood that these profound misunderstandings and significant tension would have resulted in a, you know, in a war, in a particular one that might have led to a nuclear conflict.
Okay. And of course, there have been other close calls on our side. I mean, I forget which Secretary of Defense, or was it Brzezinski? Or, I mean, there have been these cases where we thought our radar was telling us, our machines were telling us they were in
1979. It was Brzezinski who was woken up because of the there was a computer, a tape of an exercise that was low. This was back when computers had, you know, those big tapes that you put in that. And a tape was loaded into the wrong computer. A tape that portrayed an exercise. It was literally almost the plot of War Games, the movie, which came out in 1983. Speaking of how culture influences people's perceptions, but the tape was a simulation of a Soviet ICBM attack. It was realized fairly quickly that it was a tape, but not before the nuclear command and control system had already been set in motion. A conference call had been convened, and at least some officials were told that, you know, the missiles were on their way. This was in 79.
Okay, so I said I was going to try to make a connection between
this and the deep state,
between Soviet American, this near miss and other near misses and the deep state. And so here it is. I mean, as you note, and it, you know, tension between the two countries and the absence of communication between the two countries. Of course, now we're talking about Russia, not the Soviet Union per se, but basically, you know, there have been tensions between these two countries. And the more tension, the less communication, the more likely things like this will spiral out of control, right? That stands to reason. And there are people who would say that something like the deep state is now trying to foment tension with Russia and discourage constructive communication. So a kind of example might be, you know, John Brennan is no longer in office, but he is in some sense an emeritus member of the intelligence establishment. And when Trump, you know, went to Helsinki, talked to Putin, and was not as confrontational as Brennan would have liked, and was more gullible than Brennan would have liked. You know, Brennan denounces it as treason, which I personally thought was going a bit far. But at any rate, that's one of the more overt cases. There's various forms of pressure on Trump to be more confrontational with Russia. I think honestly, most of the pressure just kind of comes from the resistance, just kind of grassroots people who hate Trump. And seize on seeming reasons to criticize him. And given the fact that there is this investigation and plausible reason to believe that there was something untoward going on between with him and Russia during the campaign and so on, given all that, naturally, one thing you seize on is this whole subject matter, which puts political pressure on Trump to be more confrontational with Russia as a way of undermining the narrative that he's the Manchurian candidate and so on. And so I honestly think a lot of the pressure doesn't come from the deep state per se, but there are people who would say some of it does. Some of it comes from a kind of a Cold War mentality from within the bureaucracy, and as reflected maybe in Brennan's, in Brennan's comments, but so that's the connection I'd make. Is there not a tendency in something you could call the deep state to? I mean, it's funny, you could go both ways.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, go ahead.
Go ahead and reply, and then sorry.
Yeah, I mean, look, there is a flashpoint, a potential. A hotspot now exists in Europe. In the former Soviet satellites, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, where President Obama deployed heavy weapons to the capitals of those countries, and Russia has created new nuclear bunkers on a small strip of land it controls, and put anti-ballistic missile battery to kind of prevent any sort of NATO from resupply. There's lots going on there that could benefit from a reduction of tension between NATO and Vladimir Putin, and not an increase of tension between now. Vladimir Putin is an aggressor here. He is making these errors. I want to make it clear now. And there's no, in the sense, I mean, they call it coercive shaping is the Russian synonym for the policy through, you know, cyber effects, through kinetic campaigns, social media. I mean, this is the primary foreign policy goal of Vladimir Putin, and to sow dissension within NATO. So then you ask the question, okay, well, if you're going to do that, then what's the best response to that? Do we make sure that NATO is strong and fortified and ready to counter attack if necessary? Yes. Do we do our best to de-escalate tensions by increasing our conversations, and not simply relegating NATO to its military realm? Yes. Do we encourage the leaders of countries, not just President Trump, but Angela Merkel and others who have, you know, she has a better relationship with Putin than Trump does, to use the power of their respective executive branches, to influence and to persuade? Yes. Do we hype the threat here at home in order to justify $1 trillion worth of upgrades to our nuclear arsenal? Literally $1 trillion worth of upgrades to our nuclear arsenal. Or do we hype the immediate threat posed by Vladimir Putin to the U.S., which frankly is, there is none. We do that when we fall into our sort of partisan tribal ways. So you're right. It does kind of go both ways. And I kind of agree with you there. Now, the issue with Trump and Helsinki is not so much that, we don't want people talking to Vladimir Putin and reducing tension. I mean, we have a new START treaty that has to be re-ratified in 2021. Mm-hmm. It's just that he's kind of the worst person you want talking to any world leader. and I get that. I accept with a modification your sense on this. The modification being that a strong and NATO that is fortified against, and particularly because Russia has been very aggressive is at this point is essential. But so is continued dialogue that is based on mutual interest and not based on confrontation about you tried to steal the election or you did this or you did that, living in the past. I'm learning from you in this conversation too, because I think there is, I've always been more skeptical that, you know, that Donald Trump ever ordered that there was some grand collusion scheme there and more just sort of tacit, implicit. Yeah, sure. Do what you need to do. I'll try it out. But the danger here, or the most acute danger, is that we make policy choices based on a hyper reaction, as opposed to just, again, pursuing what is in our national interests. Mm-hmm. But look, Bob, I mean, Donald Trump is Donald Trump, and that is the fundamental reality of our time. And I don't mean to jump. And this is not a, you know, this goes back to the fact that if it was Mike Pence doing it, it would be totally different. It just would be a totally different dynamic where you could have NATO, even pressure on NATO, as Obama started to make during his administration, to, you know, fork over more money for its own defense, which is a real point, and Trump's not wrong about that. But if Mike Pence was saying it versus Donald Trump saying it, it makes a huge difference. So I can't absolve Donald Trump from this. But at the same time, your point about John Brennan, I think, is well taken. And the deep state's obsession, and I know a bunch of these Russia hands. And I think if they sat down and thought through it, they would come to agree as well. But it's so easy, particularly on social media now. This goes back to the reporter who posted the classified information. You can just, without thinking, your visceral gut thought will come out. You and I are both, I mean, you are, you know, more than I have, because I have yet to sit a retreat and many other things. But a mindful consideration before we respond to these things would is in order, and it's almost a national security priority at this point. And the deep state, individually and collectively, has to start doing some of that itself. It's not just on the president, but hyper reacting is not going to get us anywhere, because you know there's some dangerous places out there that we have to respond intelligently to.
And I should emphasize, this can work both ways. It's not as if the, quote, deep state or the intelligence establishment or intelligence defense establishment is full of rabid cold warriors. It's that.
No.
And in fact, you can imagine it working the other way. And it probably has. For example, Trump can be very cavalier in dismissing existing arms control arrangements. And I think many of the very people in the, quote, deep state who are have a little bit of cold warrior in them at the same time believe, hey, we've built up this arms control regime that is designed to minimize the chances of conflict. And right. They believe in those too. And yeah. I forget, it seems like Trump has at some point maybe even abandoned some important element of U.S.-Soviet arms control. I forget, you might know better than I, but in any event, that is the kind of attitude on his part that would be checked from the other side.
Right. Very little about arms control, other than we should continue to work on agreements. But he,
I mean, of course, he abandoned the Iran deal, which is not arms control per se, but is in the same spirit.
I mean, it's giving less visibility into an Iranian breakout. But yeah. I think that the big threat, if there is one, is that the U.S. will start to test nuclear weapons above ground again, and we'll field the technology that people know that we have, which is similar to a technology that Russia has that appears to be in violation of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, mm-hmm. which was one of the major signal accomplishments of Ronald Reagan. But we don't know. I don't think the president has much. I'm trying to think of a polite term. I don't think he has much visibility into these issues or cares about them enough to ask about them, which scares me, because there are people in his administration like John Bolton who don't like the IMF, the INF, and who want to get out of the testing.
I mean, I'll tell you, the Trump-Bolton combination is genuinely frightening, if you ask me. I mean, of course, the whole thing is frightening, but I mean, you can't. It's hard to imagine a worse combination in terms of people Trump could have plausibly picked for national security advisor. Maybe the only one that rivals this in scariness is Michael Flynn. Bolton is he's already going semi.
Yeah, well, his hobby horse is about the International Criminal Court and
right.
and stoking tension unnecessarily with Palestinians and again, in the absence of a comprehensive national security strategy that kind of makes sense and the parts fit together, the externalities, the unknown unknowns could have really, really bad effects. Unless maybe this is obviously not true, but maybe it was Bolton who wrote the New York Times op-ed. He obviously did. But
that seems implausible to me. I think even the honeymoon part of his relationship, Trump is giving him a lot of
leeway to, yeah.
Do you have a theory as to who are a few finalists?
When the story first broke, the name that popped into my head was Nick Ayers, who is the vice president, chief of staff, and a former, a guy who's a little younger than me, a very precocious former long time Republican staffer. And Omar, of all people, Omarosa believes that he is the one who wrote it. Hmm. The vice president has said that nobody in his office wrote it, so I'm assuming that is.
I'm not sure how he would know that. I doubt they would
deny
it,
right? But I think it's too cute. The other, another name was semi-plausible was John Huntsman, the ambassador to Russia, but
that's not crazy.
not crazy.
I mean, but then, I mean, geez, are we including ambassadors in senior administration official? Or only
I mean, in that sense, I would, you know, that's where, you know, Mark Emmer emails James Bennett and says, James, really? That's not a senior administration official to me.
Yeah, I mean, even though it's Russia, I mean.
Right. But I mean, it's a diplomat, you know, a senior U.S. diplomat.
Mm-hmm. Somebody was saying Larry Kudlow. Yeah. And the thing that doesn't make sense to you. I mean, what makes sense?
I mean, it could be, but Kudlow, I mean, Kudlow and Trump are personal friends. So
I didn't know Trump had actual personal friends
to the extent that he does. So yeah. It's not implausible, but
I mean, what made me think that was plausible is that it could be someone who's kind of out on the cocktail party circuit and they really don't like the way some of their old friends, not that Kudlow was ever in a particularly liberal crowd, but the way some of their old friends are kind of looking askance at them. I mean, I thought of that as one possible motivation, but I have no idea.
I mean, again, and I would make it clear that I have absolutely no evidence in the world that it is Nick Ayers. I just, that was the name that popped into my mind, and it seems plausible, but I don't.
Another Simon & Schuster author, by the way.
Another Simon & Schuster author, but I really, I don't want to slander somebody unnecessarily. So I want to make it absolutely clear that it's just, you know, like everyone else, it's just a guess.
Sure.
But I have a feeling in short order we'll probably find out, because these things, the gestation time for anything that's a secret to when it becomes a non-secret in Washington is, you know.
Well, and after they leave, at some point, either the administration will not exist or they will have left the administration. And at that point, the odds go up considerably that when they sign the big book contract.
With Simon & Schuster.
With Simon & Schuster. Yeah. So, well, thanks a lot, Mark, for taking the time. The new book is The Brink, President Reagan and the Nuclear War Scare of 1983. The earlier book is Deep State, which you co-authored with somebody, right?
With David Brown, who was a wonderful writer, who made the writing of that book really well.
Okay, all right. Well, thanks. You'll have to come back at some point.
Anytime
as the story evolves. All right. Take care.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.